Good afternoon, everybody. I am absolutely delighted to be here with you. We have each year for 10 years, a whole decade, created the Ag Issues Forum. Every year has been better than the last year, and I guarantee you this one will promise and deliver the same as well. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Beth Roden and her team for creating the concept and creating the momentum that results in a day like today where you honor us with your presence here and commitment for a day of hearing what's going on in the Ag Issues Forum. So when thinking about this year's Ag Issues Forum theme, Feeding Imagination Today and Nourishing Tomorrow, I found myself thinking about the future and also with 10 years or a decade thinking a little bit about my past and my personal past. And so I wanted to take you just a little bit back in time to the land of 50-pound bales. I grew up on a farm in Iowa. We hauled around 50-pound rectangular bales like maybe many of you did. I had my father's permission to haul more than one at a time if I wanted to, and I appreciated that. And it was long days, it was fun days. You got trapped in the dust in the haymount, or you were out on the rack and the food came out and the fun. But it was quite a social event. Neighbors helped neighbors, and it was a fun day. But today, bales are in big round bales, as you know, or great big rectangular bales the size of small cars. And they make us more efficient with our harvesting. It requires much less labor, and it's better nutrition. It's wrapped up, it's better preserved, and it tastes better to cows. But better nutrition, better preservations. And you know what? Cows like that. They like that better tasting hay. So what else happened to us in the time that I left Iowa? Is the big blue harvesters in the silos disappeared. And just as they sit unused or they're being taken out, it's being replaced by those long, wide plastic bags. Again, better efficiencies, the giant bunkers, better storage, better nutrient preservation. The stuff that we see happening right before our eyes. When I was a teenager in the late 70s, and the late 70s means I have personally seen every episode of the Brady Bunch, every episode of Gilligan's Island, like maybe many of you have as well, we were warming up to a concept called no-till. People were trying to do it. People were doing things. On our farm, we were proud to have a 6 or an 8-bottom moldboard plow. We got out in the fall after the crop was out. We turned that soil over, but depending on the horsepower that we had in the tractor was how many bottoms we could pull. When the frost or the freezing temperatures came in, we did it all night to beat the frost, and that's what we did. When spring came, we came out with this very rough ground, raw exposed dirt, and we disced it down. And sometimes we disced it twice, and once in one direction and once in the other. We wanted that very pristine, flat seed bed. We wanted to break down the big chunks of dirt into small chunks of dirt. And why did we want to do that? Because the tools of the day really demanded that. We had herbicides that did a great job at that time of creating a barrier on a flat surface. But if the ground was too chunky and there was clods out there, you'd spray the clod, and when it broke down over time with rainfall, unexposed or untreated dirt would come, weed seeds would come, and you'd have a weedy field. We also wanted that pristine ground seed bed because that's what planters needed. The planters of the day worked better with those plates, remember the mechanical plates, at putting seed in and doing that. But today, no-till is widely practiced. And why is that? Because the tools of today were proven. We have burned-down herbicides. We don't have to do it to kill the winter annual weeds that came up in the field. We can protect the topsoil and highly erodible soils. We have herbicides with better technology that are smart. They know that when there's crop residue in the field, we can spray that crop residue. We can let rain take it down so it comes off that crop residue. It still goes with a nice blanket across the soil, and it knows to stop there. We killed the weeds with residual products like or burn down products like glufosinate ammonium, our brand of Liberty, and we're ready to plant. And we can plant into that tough residue because the equipment manufacturers gave us MaxEmerge planters and other technology that was tough, planted it in. And by the way, by now we're blowing it in, right? Blowing that seed in there. So also, way back when I came out of college, we had several tools of the day for herbicides. They were called Treflan. They were called Sencor. They were called Basagran. And we used them, and we thought they were very effective. In today's world, if you ask a kid to talk about Amaben, they're going to give you a sleeping aid. But back then, Amaben, instead of Ambien, was a very effective soybean herbicide. But we've gone a long ways from there. Today, thanks to products like Liberty Herbicide plus the Liberty Leg Trait System, farmers are keeping weeds down, yields up, and we're committed to continue this even as new threats arrive. Bayer is one of the few companies that continue to invest in small molecule research for chemistries to come online now, and thank goodness we did. Whenever the rest of the world went to seeds and traits, we maintained our pipeline, and we have some of the strongest tools for resistance management in the GMO trait systems today. You know, even 10 years ago, the seeds and traits were not as sophisticated as they are today. And that's due in part to companies like us. At Bayer Crop Science, we have strong, deep research and development roots. We have a future commitment investment of $1 billion in the United States between the years of 2013 and 2016. And that's commitment. That commitment is going to go for new laboratories, new greenhouses, new breeding stations, expanding our production capacities in sites like our new Memphis warehouse and greenhouse in Memphis for our cotton and soybean trait integration. It's a world-class, state-of-the-art automated greenhouse, to places like our global biologics headquarters, where we're studying and doing R&D on the biologicals, the cutting-edge frontier of this industry in West Sacramento. And, of course, in our Research Triangle Park headquarters in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. And one thing we have to say, that we are absolutely thrilled that our customers have created and drove the demand for our products that allows us to continue to invest in the future pipeline and the future cutting-edge technologies that, oddly enough, 10 years from now, as they come through the registration process, will be what we'll be talking about on the second decade of Ag Information's Forum. So you might be asking, Jim, why this trip down your memory lane, right? Because we know your memory is not that good anymore and you're getting a little bit older. But because when I think about how farming has changed in my lifetime, and the issue that we've faced and seen evolve over the past 10 years of Ag Issues Forum, I see a direct correlation to the experiences I've had recently. These experiences that I've had recently were in venues where 10 years ago, folks like me representing agriculture growing up on a farm would not have been present. We had to fight it to get in. We weren't wanted. And I wanted to share my experience of a recent example later. But when we needed to get in, we had to make sure we were there, fight to get in, and make sure that we had a consistent, concise message to be heard. So I want to share my experiences with you because they underscore how critical it is to our industry that we demonstrate the need for innovation, technology, and our commitment to the responsible production and continuous improvement. I took it into my own hands in November, and I was honored with a piece in the Washington Post editorial page. And we did this because it became very clear that public interest in our industry has grown quickly, and too many times that interest sounds like alarmism and misunderstanding. So although we appreciate the spotlight being shown on us, we're not happy with the message or the misinformation getting out, and we have to take it personally to go out and correct that issue. This editorial gave us a great chance to shed light on how we've progressed as an industry, through a diligent focus on science and technology, on proven science and technology. So it was a new experience. A person like myself working for a crop science company using a forum and a vehicle as unlikely as the Washington Post to get our message out and be heard. That's something that just didn't happen 10 years ago. Innovation in the name of progress is the name of the game. Significant changes have occurred. Today, the average farmer feeds about with fewer inputs and improved conservation methods and expending fewer natural resources. He can feed 155 people. In 1960, it was 26. At Bayer, we value our role in that difference. And it is why we continue to invest in sound science to achieve advancements. And we imagine what progress will look like just 10 years from now. What's different in the coming decade is the increasing level of public's interest, decisions at the grocery store shelf, using smartphones to research products. We're going to see it very, very quickly now, where the barcode on a piece of fruit or produce is going to serve two different functions. One will be to tell the price and the inventory stocking and all the distribution needs for the company selling the produce. The second piece of information on that barcode is going to give the user inspecting it a chance to zap it with his smartphone and be taken directly to the citrus grove where the citrus was, to talk about the sustainability of the citrus grove, to talk about how animals are produced, how they're harvested, to talk about what we're doing in certain vegetable crops and others to preserve water and the sustainability and documenting that. We're doing that because that's what the customer wants. They demand transparency, they're demanding more information, and it's our job to make sure it's available to them. So I consider it an honor and a responsibility to be a more strong advocate for how we educate about the advances to help people understand how deeply we care about agriculture and that we do, in fact, have responsible approaches and solutions. At Bayer Crop Science, we will continue to be a leader of what we would like to call ag-vocating, basically what we're just talking about here. I saw recently a food and how we're going to feed 9.6 billion people when the New York Times took it upon themselves to create a seminar called Food for Tomorrow. It wasn't in Des Moines or anywhere near that area. It was in White Plains, New York. But it was basically their opinions and in getting this conversation started about how to feed 9.6 billion people in 2015. You know, these people as a group, there was about 260 there. They were highly intelligent. They were very passionate. They were genuine individuals from across the spectrum of NGOs, of the private sector, and of public organizations. They addressed similar issues to what we'll discuss here at Ag Issues Forum about food security, sustainable farming practices, and ag policy and climate change, and specifically focused on the health and nutrition issues. At this seminar, and at this convention for a day and a half, 2 days, they were very proud of the fact that they fed all of us there for that period of time with just 3 hogs. They were very proud of the fact that they did that. I was very hungry. So without further ado, I'd like to just share a short video with you. The video is from Mark Pittman, one of the sponsors and chairs of organizing this seminar. The video is very short. He's going to talk fairly fast. I want you to pay very close attention to this introductory, doing what I'm doing today, opening up the ceremony of what they're going to talk about from Mark Pittman.
America feeds the world is a lame excuse for continuing the worst of industrial farming, which means abuse of land, water, animals, eaters, labor, just about everything involved. There's a war here, a war of worldviews and of tactics and of strategy. And for those of us in the food movement, the fact that there is a war, the fact that we're finally able to force powerful industry leaders to listen is a really good thing, because up until recently, we were largely ignored.
So I told you it was a short clip, but I want to highlight 3 things he said. First, he talked about their favorite term of industrial farms. And in their terms, that's a bad thing. Industrial has a negative concept. So it was introduced, it was used and used and used at this concept. The second thing I wanted to lift up and highlight was the use in the words of abuse. It's a system, industrial agriculture is a system that abuses the land, the environment, the animals, the laborers. You heard the list. And lastly, the third thing I wanted to reemphasize that I think you heard very quickly is that this group thought that they were at war with the people that were putting food on their plate each night, basically exclaiming that there's a war going on. So without a doubt, I was one of maybe 19 people involved in production agriculture that were invited, and only invited because we fought to get in. And my friend Frank was there as well. We'll talk about that a little bit. But we were a little bit lonely in our view of what's going on there. But it was awakening that for far too long, conversations like this have been happening without us. that allowed it to get to this level of what they thought was common understanding of a view of how this industry worked and what we were about. The consumers are asking to reconnect to their food system, but they are finding answers, and far too often fear, in places where the farmers you and I know so well do not exist. And we've got to address that. So we believe connection is the key. There's a quest for an improved food system that's maturing into a full-fledged movement. It's a movement that portrays farmers, the crops they grow, and the companies that serve them as the villains in the drama of climate change, obesity, and even poverty. At the heart of that movement are several beliefs, including big is bad, only local is sustainable, and back then is better than innovation and technology. The same people that will wait an entire day in line to get the latest version of an iPhone would rather have their food grown on a farm with a team of mules. It's a weird dichotomy. It's a weird divergence of thought and acceptance. We have to figure out how to communicate to crack that code. Our continued success as an industry depends not only on how effectively we can connect with consumers and other groups, but also sharing with them why we do what we do. The question is, how do we accomplish that as a group? How do we get effective, efficient, and communicate? As you know, Bayer Crop Science is an R&D company. We live it, we breathe it, and it's the reason we continually deliver the great products and innovations to the marketplace that helps our customers thrive. But recently, we invested in research and development of another type. Research about what our consumers think. Our research tells us that consumers still want to and do trust farmers, but they also want stricter laws and regulations and food grown without pesticides. They are concerned with farming practices, they want the environment protected, and they definitely still want a consistent and affordable food supply. One last finding from our research, consumers want to know more about agriculture, and what's even more interesting, they want to understand why we make the choices that we do. The opportunities are out there every day. It's up to farmers and other ag folks to continue to engage with consumers, opinion makers, food writers, and others who are more and more concerned with where their food comes from. A bit about the Washington Post editorial that we posted in November. We talked about passionate people. They can respectively disagree about the way that we grow our crops today, but there is no disputing the fact that scientific advances have helped make American agriculture the envy of the world. Our industry has embraced this scientific revolution because it's necessary to help feed a growing world population. The amount of food we'll need to produce in the next 20 years is twice the amount of food we produced in the last 10,000 years. In order to meet those projections, we owe it to ourselves to continue the pursuit of agriculture and technological innovations. Bayer Crop Science has and will continue to invest millions to develop new technology to fight challenges like weed resistance and new pests, because on top of everything else, there is always Mother Nature, and she's the tough one. So as journalists in our industry, I ask for your help today. I want you to help our growers reach people not as familiar with ag so that they can have a better platform to be heard. I want you to help the efforts of our crop associations and farm bureaus by opening doors to talk to and build relationships with people in more urban areas. Help us connect with the consumers on social media. I'd like to ask you to help us bring more opinion leaders out to farms, so that they can see the science and technology that's ingrained in what we do and see firsthand how we make decisions and why we make decisions. And most importantly, help us as an industry raise our profile in the minds and hearts of not just consumers, but stakeholders everywhere. Because if someone is sitting down, as you see in a picture here, if someone is sitting down to a meal, they're a part of the food system. So you know my roots run deep when it comes to agriculture. I grew up on a family farm in Hubbard, Iowa, right in the middle of the state. When I was young, I thought it was the middle of nowhere. I've come to believe and understand it was the middle of everywhere. I'm proud of the work that we do at Bayer Crop Science. I'm proud of the work I did on that farm, and I want to help growers shape the future of agriculture and everything that we do. So I want to thank you in advance for all that you do today, and thank you to everyone who's live streaming from your own homes and offices today as we open this dialogue. And we feed our imaginations today so we can nourish the world tomorrow. Thank you. I'm going to ask Frank to come up and chat with me for a moment. Frank?
What a coincidence. Let's sit here.
It was almost scripted.
Now I know it. It's very interesting listening to you and thinking back. As you mentioned, I was at the New York event too, and the panel that I moderated there was called Big Ag, Big Food, How Being Good for the Environment is Not About Size. And I talked with farmers and ranchers from across the country. And what was striking then and what is striking in listening to you, and I'm sure that many in the audience have had this experience, is how much of agriculture has been put on the defensive in this discussion. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this some more. Is this because so few people are involved in agriculture? Is this because of the larger media environment? What do you think are the big drivers of this?
Great question. Here's what I think, Frank. I think I can talk about being on a farm. I think lots of rural Americans could talk about at least going to their grandfather's farm to see how animals are raised, to see how crops are grown, to see that seeds grow into harvestable crops. As the millennials come along and as more and more people come along and we become more urbanized, I think we lose touch with where our food comes from, and we just can't relate. And once you lose touch, it's easier to make harsher decisions. It's easier to divorce yourself from reality. It's easier to make your own reality. And I think that's the difference that we're facing every day going forward. There's no doubt that the most sustainable person out there is a seventh-generation farmer. He has benefited from those that had came before him. Every decision he makes that day is about how do I protect this land, make it better, and be able to pass it off like it was passed off to me and keep this family farm in our family name. And so to question him and his motives and why he's doing what he's doing and to think that he would take shortcuts that would undermine his children's future is just a lack of understanding.
You know, we also see, and you have this in your name, Bear Crop Science, right? We see this sort of anti-science movement in some places, and whether it's in food or it's in vaccines, there's this pushback. Mm-hmm. Do we as journalists need to think about science differently? Is that a word and that a concept that also is contributing to this?
I view science as a great word. Science is a very definitive word, but in today's world with more and more people, it's not a black and white. We follow science, good or bad, wherever it takes us. These are facts. Either it allows us to gain our way to a registration with the government into a safe product on the marketplace, or it doesn't meet those hurdles and it dies within our development opportunity. Too often now in today's discussions with people who aren't as familiar, we get terms like, that's your science.
Oh, really?
And that's not true. You know,
what do you say when someone says that?
Well, it tells you how you need to approach that person, right? Because the science or the facts are not going to win this argument. It's not going to help you communicate with them. It's not going to drive this to an understanding between the two. So you have to back up and understand and explain the process. We do all of this work with the government over 10 years with $150 to $200 million involved in the process of meeting the standards that they set. Once a product's on the market, science continues to evolve. We have redefined zero many, many times. Why? Because it's many decimal points behind it now. As analytical equipment gets better, we can measure different, and we have new standards that we apply to old products in the re-registration process. And that's what people don't understand, is that we are getting better at science, we are getting better at measuring things, and everything on the market to remain on the market, regardless of whether it was discovered in the 40s or in the 2000s, meets those standards.
So when you talk about advocacy, which is a great word, but sometimes a little hard to say.
A little difficult, I agree.
I have to watch how many beers I have before I do that.
You should watch that anyway.
I should, especially if I'm driving home. When you talk about that, it's toward what end? Is it to change public opinion, change public policy, merely make sure that people who are eating food know where it's coming from? You're probably going to say all of the above and then some, but what are you trying to accomplish with
No, it's a great question. So what do we want? We want people to be aware of the need to speak up, number one, kind of what we try to do in this presentation right here. there's a big body of non-education out there, and there's a need and a thirst for it. So understand that it is important when you're related to this industry to take the opportunity to speak when the opportunity comes. Then it's incumbent that you take the time to train yourself to be consistent and concise and compelling. You can't just throw studies at them. You can't drop things on them. You have to figure out at what point and what emotion they're coming from and then work into that and talk to them. It's very important. You know, in business, a lot of times people talk about their elevator speech. If you have a short period of time to make your point with a key executive in an elevator, what are you going to say? It's important to know when the opportunity comes and the platform presents itself at a PTA meeting, at a grocery store, even with people that you meet within your local schools, that when you tell them what industry you're in or what company you work for or that you grow food for America, that you know how to communicate with those people in a concise fashion.
Okay, so we're at a cocktail party with Jim Bloom, okay? And you meet somebody for the first time, and they say, hi, Jim, how are you? And you say, you're fine. And they ask you what you do, and you tell them. Where do they go? What do they want to know from you?
It's a great question, because some people at a cocktail party will just say they work for Bayer, or they just work for a pharmaceutical company, or will dodge the basis, right? We can't do that. We're very proud of what we do. We spend time each year right before the holiday season going over this with our employees about how to address this at a cocktail party. Don't shrink from this.
Seriously?
This is an
role-play cocktail party? I didn't want to work for you.
No. We roll out talking points, right? Be proud. Speak with pride. Take the opportunity to engage people. They have time. They have the inquisitive, and they're standing in front of you and not walking away because they want to hear what you have to say. Now, what are you going to say? It's talking about the fact that everything is registered, the science is real, the science is renewed, and that we do the studies based on the most recent analytical standards and what we know. And when we learn more, we redo it. We don't willy-nilly do things. We don't leave things on the marketplace when better things come along. This business is about innovation, and it's the result of that innovation that has a cheap, affordable, safe food supply for everyone. They want to know, a lot of people want to confuse us with animal health people about how animals are raised. We have the opportunity and the responsibility to be versed in how to address that as well and to talk to that about how it could go. But what you can't get in is to, here's what my science says, or I don't trust your science, or, you know, you have to embrace, have empathy, and engage.
I want to turn to the audience for a question, and I'll look for a hand for somebody who's brave and is going to get us launched on this 20, look at that, all the way in the back, and there's a mic right there. Tell everybody who you are, where you're from, and fire away.
I'm Jeff Downey with the Cromwell Ag Radio Network. Question, Jim, after the meeting in New York, did you change minds? Did you feel like you had the opportunity to make an impact, and did they hear you?
The most effective people or the most engaging people at the cocktail hours, because they gave us several, they didn't give us much to eat, but they gave us time to mingle with a drink or two.
Oh, am I wrong? I should have brought you a Hershey bar. I wish I know.
But the most engaging people or open-minded people were bloggers. People coming in simply because they wanted to talk about the subject. I had several bloggers coming in and really asking good questions and talking and wanted to spend time out. We had some university people that weren't so engaging. Had a few people that were actually rude. And
to you personally?
Yes. And were wondering why I was there, which I thought told me a lot, right? A farm boy from Iowa, raised on a farm, been in this business all my life, was talking to an
academic. But they see you as big business, the other side of the war, right? I mean, that's where that comes from.
Right. Big is bad.
Did you engage them?
We tried. We talked. As we sat in those dinners and we had random seating, we did.
Do you think there's a war?
I definitely don't think there's a war. I think it's very noble to feed the world. I think finding technology in the way to make it do it safer, more efficient, and sustainable is noble. And I think if we don't do that, we're going to have a war over food or fresh water. So I think there's no war. I think they are just misinformed, and we have an obligation to make sure that they're informed because they're passionate, they're intelligent, and they need information.
Some of them claim they have science on their side.
That's right. And we have long discussions about peer-reviewed science and reputable periodicals that you're being published in and that kind of stuff. And that's where you get into that discussion of your science versus our science. But there is a definition of scientific method in peer-reviewed science.
Next question. Front row. This is the... Go ahead.
Thank you. And it's great to hear your stories there, Jim. To you, Jim, first of all, I'm Patrick Cavanaugh with California Ag Today Radio Network and some print magazines out in California. Jim, when you wrote that column, that thoughtful column in the Wall Street Journal, what comments? Do they have any comments at the bottom of that online? Was it put online, and were people able to comment on it? What kind of positive or negative things came from that?
Absolutely. There's several comments about, I'm not sure how you got through onto this venue, right? It's so unusual to have this kind of a point of view represented in the Washington Post. So we got a lot of comments of disbelief. We got a lot of support. And then we had some from the other side that actually were concerned about us being vested only in our financial well-being, of being a big corporation, big is bad.
To that point, though, and actually pinging off the preceding question as well, do you think that what effect do you think your public engagement with these issues is having? Are you changing some minds? Are you getting other people into the discussion?
I think we are. I think as a result, I've actually been asked to do several speaking opportunities where into chemical manufacturing and outside of the ag, talking about the issues, talking about what we're doing, and the difficulty of explaining science to the general population, because everybody has the same issues, whether it's the gamut of issues. And so I think if I could do anything, just the awakening that you need to be prepared and you need to speak up has gotten people to go to websites. I'm very proud of our industry website. We've gotten together among the biotechnology companies and have GMOanswers.com, where we're very straightforward, very brief, very clear Q&A for anybody who has questions and wants an easy place to go do that, rather than dividing and having different messages. It's a very simple story. We have to be concise, and we have to deliver it.
Another question. This side of the room. There's a hand in the back.
Chuck Zimmerman with AgWire.com. And Jim, I think I heard you say earlier you were urging us to help bring thought leaders out to the farm, which is a great idea, and I know that does happen. But how can perhaps a company like Bayer help in terms of efforts like that, maybe on local levels around the country? We're all out of ag media here. Mm-hmm. How would you envision ag media getting into doing that on localized basis? Just ideas, suggestions, and
absolutely,
what if Bayer might be able to help?
You know, we would all love to take policy or public opinion makers and put them on a bus and take them to a farm. But the reality is...
Would you bring them back is the question.
That, yeah. But the reality is that's probably not going to happen. So the most effective thing that I've seen is guiding people on how to make a short video, and then taking advantage of demonstrating, like I just did with Mark Pittman here, of just sending something that's interesting, concise, open-ended, but telling them why. I've seen very good short videos of bringing the farm to the public on a family dairy farm and why they do what they do and the family involvement and what it really means to be certified and to put milk into the system. So I think that's probably the best thing we can do is find an interesting venue, capture the interest of the policymakers, and bring the farm to them through video with a follow-up of being open, of taking them there if they're interested further. But we've got to get over a lot of humps of interest and attention span first. We've got to engage them and get them going, because right now they think they know and they don't want to hear from big industrial agriculture.
Let me play off of that question, too, with another thought. One of the things we talk about a lot in communicating science is the very, very fundamental disconnect between science and journalism, for example, and much of the real world. Science lives in the world of uncertainty. It is in the process of exploring and discovering the unknown. Journalism wants a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end that's pretty certain. Politics surely wants certainty. They want an answer. They want to, you fight the war, you win the war, and move on, right? As president and CEO of this company and someone who is both knowledgeable of the science and tries to communicate it, and seeing these almost different cultures, mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts about how, as storytellers, we can bridge that better?
Yeah, you absolutely hit on it. It's telling it in a story fashion, taking your science, taking your facts. You saw me talking about in my presentation today about growing up on a farm and personalizing it, telling a story, why it was important to me personally, giving personal examples. And I think that's important when you're delivering facts in the middle of that storytelling to be compelling, to gain the interest, gain the ear, and gain the attention span for a little more difficult or complicated message. Keep going until you lose them, but keep working more and more facts into it until you lose their interest because they're not oriented that way.
Mm-hmm. Another question. Right here in the middle. Mike is on the way.
Hi, I'm Jenny Schweigert with the AgChat Foundation, and we're in the business of training farmers and ranchers to tell their stories and how to use video and Twitter and whatnot. What is your best advice for farmers and ranchers to reach beyond the choir and to talk outside of our ag community?
I think it would be just that. Every time your children come home from school and talk about seeing Food Inc. in school for the third time at school, you have to speak up and say, you know, I want to talk to that teacher. I want to have a platform to tell the other side of the story instead of just saying, oh, there they go again, right? That's what they have. That's the effective communication message that's out there. We have to address it every time we meet it, even at that level. So making sure that you take an opportunity. More people will do that if they're trained and confident that when they get the spotlight, they know what to do. So even arm them with short videos, and I'm a big proponent of short videos, so that you can actually be heard, and some talking points, and start from there.
How short is a short video for you?
For us, our rule of thumb, anything under 3.5 minutes.
Okay, and the short video tells a personal story, argues a point, introduces people to something they didn't know. I mean, what should that do?
The way we decide what to do it on is what do people want to hear about and what do they need more information on, and we want them to become seeing us as the answer to that in a quick, efficient way.
So something that's new or something
that's topical of interest, and they know that we won't waste their time and we'll deliver it efficiently.
Okay. I think I saw one last question in the back. Where was that? There we go.
Roger Ward, WLDS Radio, Jackson, Illinois, and a farmer as well, but you talked about the disconnect from the agriculture, but so many of the current farmers are baby boomers who have children who are in the big cities, who are reluctant because of fear of being discriminated against, I guess, because they grew up on a farm. How do you convince those people in positions, whether it's New York, California, or wherever, to speak on behalf of agriculture out of the fear of being questioned too much about their upbringing?
No, it's a great question in a real scenario, right? I'm going to stay under the cover, right? And I think if you talk to them about what that could lead to, I mean, we have a noble approach. We want to feed the world. We already have 800 million or maybe a billion people going to bed at hungry every night, right? And it's going to get worse. So the ability to do that is to have a responsible regulatory structure, the need to do things based on sound science, and the need to support that rather than fear or... We cannot regulate pesticides in our industry based on likes on Facebook, right? I like my neighbor, but he's not qualified to vote through the internet whether this is safe or not. I do the data. I give it to EPA. They are qualified experts. They judge it. It's their job to do that, and they need to communicate that out, and we need to appreciate and support that system rather than say we know better and we have better information. So it's just educating the fact that We need education, we need support, and it's for the better good of the world, quite frankly, that we preserve our fresh water and feed the world.
Last question, then we need to move on. From where you sit, from that farm where you started and this trajectory that you're on, biggest opportunity, biggest challenge that you as a company in agriculture faces over the next 5 years?
The biggest challenge, as I said earlier, we're investing $1.1 billion a year in R&D. The biggest challenge is having a regulatory system process that's long, which is fine, but that can change during the period of time. No one will play with a kid who changes the rules all the time, right? And in high-stakes investment, we can't afford to invest in the unknown. We set up business models. We make investment decisions. We bring this new technology on based on a set of known regulatory systems. We can't change it in midstream. We have to continuously upgrade it with new technology under the current system, and it allows for that. But to radically change it and go from the system that we're on now based on sound science to one based on risk management that, or perceived risk or likes on a Facebook page will not bring the new technology to the marketplace.
And the opportunity?
I think the biggest opportunity we're going on is the great unknown of where research is taking us into the healthy soil area, understanding even more on a microbiology level of how things work together, how we can enhance systems. We're on a drive to provide integrated crop solutions, right? All the way from the seed to the seed and tray to the chemicals to the nutrient use and putting that all together with services and data to make real-time decisions that will show you a return on investment and let farmers do a better job of running their business and documenting what they're doing on the farm. And so I think that's the big opportunity that's coming on. With the advent of better and better science, we see further and further down into the unknown.
That's great. Well, I think you still have some of those 50-pound bales around.
I do.
Yeah, it looks good. Jim Bloom, thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Jim Bloom.